OTB.
Bemused, I think, is probably how he feels in his head. Bemused how they could go from where they were last season, 99 points, 67 games unbeaten at home, to a situation where they could be on the edge today of losing six games in a row at home.
OTB live commentary. Never miss the action right here on OTB Sports Radio. Keep up to date with the latest scores on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Sports app. Live score updates straight to your phone. The OTB Podcast Network.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
And you're very, very welcome along to the Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball here. John Duggan sitting in today for Joe Molloy. And I'm delighted to be joined by Sarah O'Donovan, the former All-Ireland Camogie winner with Cork and also an inter-county player with Dublin, and the CEO of Titan Experience, Owen Conroy, a sports event and experiential company dealing with brands and sporting bodies. Sarah and Owen, happy Mother's Day. Hope you're well.
I'm delighted to be here on Mother's Day, and I'd like to say hello to my mum on Mother's Day. That's worth a couple of brownie points, surely.
Absolutely, Owen. Yeah, it's definitely worth some brownie points, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. I just finished the... my own mother is no longer with us. My own wife now had a relaxed morning with three little Conroys running around after her. So they're gone off now with the dog for a walk. So we have some nice peace and quiet for the next hour.
Shout out to my own mother as well. She's 82 and she got the vaccine on Friday. So that's definitely a relief for everybody. But happy Mother's Day to everybody out there. Just got to go through the back pages. Like, lots of stuff going on with Ireland playing Scotland and the Six Nations at 3 o'clock. Lots of sports news. Plenty to get through. Really good stories today in the Sunday papers. Just go through the Sun Independent. Smooth City back to winning ways. Manchester City back scoring, what, 8 goals in the last couple of games after the Manchester United defeat. That was a win over Fulham last night, 3-0 at Craven Cottage. We have Farrell's focus on Ireland's attitude. This is ahead of the game in the Six Nations at 3 o'clock at the Murrayfield game. That is the Sunday Independent. At the front page of the Sunday Times, fans at Cup Final with no social distancing. So 20,000 fans will be allowed into the FA Cup Final as a test event for the return of supporters under government plans in the UK. Fans attending the FA Cup Final and the snooker will have to return a negative lateral test and will be tested again after the events. The idea is that it'll mean they will not need to comply with social distancing. The FA Cup Final set to take place on May the 15th. Win or bust in the Sunday Times. Judgment Day in Murrayfield as Ireland bid to avoid a first losing campaign since 2013. That's in the Sunday Times. Back at the Sunday Mirror, and there's three of these stories all by the same journalist, so he's got a scoop around the back of the tabloids, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Ole's the man for United. Boss Solskjaer lands a £9 million a year new deal. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has won a new £9 million a year contract at Manchester United. Sources at Old Trafford saying talks are due to begin any day in a new deal, with his current 3-year contract set to click into its final year later this month. That is the back of the Sunday Mirror, the back of the Sunday People. Ole hits £9 million job jackpot. United poised to reward Gaffer with new mega deal. So what they've done at United in the last week, they've got John Murta in there as now football director, Darren Fletcher as technical director. Ed Woodward likes Solskjaer. He sees him as this guy. I think this story is true. I think Solskjaer is going to get a new deal at Manchester United. Gunnar see a deal. Ole will sign up for £9 million a year. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, two great Man United exclusives. And £50 million Pope on the radar. This is Nick Pope, the Burnley goalkeeper, on the summer shopping list. What does that mean for De Gea? What does that mean for Dean Henderson if it does happen? The Sunday World, con for the cop. Kevin Palmer writing that Klopp is to splash £34 million on Leipzig defender Ibrahima Konate. This is the Frenchman in a bid to solve the defensive problems at the club. Tribute's been paid to the Observer here. Look, it was a story that came last night, so not that much obviously considered comment about Murray Walker, but tribute's paid to the beloved voice of motorsport, Murray Walker, who's very sadly passed away at the age of 97. Walker will be remembered as the undisputed voice of the sport. His unique high-octane style, once described by the Observer's Australian TV critic Clive James as sounding like a man whose trousers are on fire, is forever ingrained in British sporting culture. From James Hunt's 1976 championship triumph over Niki Lauda at a rain-lashed Fuji to Ayrton Senna's intense rivalry with Alan Prost and Nigel Mansell's 1992 title triumph, Walker called it all in a remarkable broadcasting career which spanned 52 years. May he rest in peace. Murray Walker, also rest in peace, Marvin Hagler, the middleweight champion, one of the best boxers in history. Was the undisputed middleweight champion from 1980 to 1987, and he very sadly passed away at the age of 66 yesterday. The back of the Daily Mail, we have Let It All Out about the rugby. This is Ireland and Scotland. Ireland can put their Six Nations frustrations behind them by beating a fired-up Scots in Murrayfield today, by Rory Keane. And an exclusive interview with Padraig Harrington and Philip Quinn will touch upon. And also, I'm not a doping doctor. Exclusive interview with the medic. This is Richard Freeman at the Centre of Cycling Scandal. Well, we saw what the evidence was during the week. In the back of the Sun, we'll also touch upon Graham Geraghty. I wouldn't be religious, but at one stage I just remember saying, God, just let me go, let me die. Great to see Graham Geraghty back in the mend after his very serious illness last October. And Roy Keane on Celtic. Ireland legend wants the Hoops job. This is a job he turned down, Roy Keane, a few years ago by Alan Nixon. Roy Keane wants to become the Celtic manager and make a sensational box office return to Scottish football. That is at the back of the Sun. The front of the Sun, Irish ace in sex vid shame. Connolly in lockdown romp. Irish footballer Aaron Connolly broke UK lockdown rules to have a sex session with a woman that ended up being recorded. That is according to the Sun. I'll just elaborate on that story. Brighton say that we are aware of the allegations made. We take them extremely seriously. The matter will be fully investigated internally and dealt with in the appropriate manner. So Aaron Connolly breached UK COVID lockdown rules. That is the accusation in the front page of the Sun today. And obviously we'll see what Brighton say and what actually will come out in the wash when it comes to that story. Sarah, where do you want to begin? I think equal pay is something that I saw was Ali Toomey coming about this week, the Camogie player, and it's something that with the merger now of the GPA and the women's GPA, it's a topic that has got a bit of airing in the Sunday papers, but not just for Gaelic players, also in golf.
Absolutely. I suppose I was a bit apprehensive picking up the newspapers this morning. I just didn't know what I was going to get on Women's Day, or Mother's Day, should I say, and International Women's Week. And you know what? I was pleasantly surprised. There was lots of prominent stories, no more so than the Philip Lanigan story with Lisa McGuire. So Lisa McGuire is a former golfer. She now works for Modest Golf, and her sister Leona McGuire is golfing on the LGPA Tour. So Leona McGuire had great results last week when she had a birdie to birdie finish to finish tied sixth at the Drive on Championship in Toledo, Ohio. And this obviously comes on the back of Modest Golf announcement a couple of weeks ago that the ISPS Honda World Invitational, which runs from July 29th to August 1st at Galgorham in Antrim, will have men and women competing on the same course for equal prize money. So big news for golf with that announcement by Modest Golf.
That's Niall Horan's company, I think.
It is. And Lisa talks very positively about Niall and I suppose his input. And what she talks about is Niall Horan lending his support and that exposure, opening up golf to girls, you know. And I suppose we'll see a theme running through the newspapers today about growth in sport and, you know, exposure to grow sports. And this is no better case in point with Niall Horan of One Direction, very famous, you know, hordes of fans, you know, turning up last year to see him at a tournament, girls, you know, notably. And I suppose the bounce for girls now is that the likes of Leona McGuire, an Irish star, is actually really, really making an impact. And she now becomes a role model for players to see. And that's what Lisa says, you know, it's great for my sister to be a role model and for that exposure to be taken, you know, seriously.
And we also have the issue of equality of funding in Gaelic games on the agenda in the Sunday Times here.
Yeah, so Maria Kinsella she's a stalwart, an incredible, advocate for women in sport currently. And Michael Foley has a piece with Maria in the Sunday Times today. And what she says basically is that women's teams are hoping that they will soon receive the funding and facilities that they need. You know, we're talking about equality, but we're also talking about equity. Give us what we can to improve and develop so that we get to a level where we can talk about equality and funding, you know. And a couple of key things here. We're constantly talking about how a merger between the men and women's teams or organizations, what that would look like. And Maria makes a great point here. She talks about her own club. And she talks about bringing both clubs together, her brother's team and her own team. And what happened was both teams, so the first team was Fina, And the second team was her own club, which was St. Bertrand's. Now, I hope I didn't mispronounce that. But her own club amalgamated with Fina. And she said there was an emotional sacrifice. So she talks about the crest is gone. The colour of the jersey was different from the men's. That's gone. Whether I was emotionally attached to the crest and the red and black jersey, that all had to be scrapped. So in recognising that they had to give up something in order to amalgamate with the men's teams, she said, this change was not made for us. I think now about the group of girls at eight, under eight and under nine, and what they're going to get. It's going to be equal to their brothers. And I think that's what we have to look at in terms of the amalgamation of the LGFA, the Camogie Association and the GPA and the GA. There will be emotional sacrifices on all sides, but ultimately we're talking about everybody getting the same opportunities at eight and nine. So we are building for the future. And while currently that's difficult, that has to be a consideration.
It's not going to happen, though, is it, until they merge the Camogie and Ladies Football Associations into the GA properly, though, is it? The support for, I was looking at the 93% of female intercounty players, 70%, 93% no travelling expenses, 77% gap in overall funding, 3 million for the men compared to 700,000 for the women, with the merger of the GPA and the women's GPA. And she says that it's not lip service. Like, one thing about that made me feel comfortable at the merging was the level of commitment on the other side of the table to do this for the right reasons. It wasn't just to tick a box and show their gender diverse. They get this. But until you have the merger of the Camogie, which Liam O'Neill has called for, the ladies Gaelic football and the GA, you're not going to get that cohesion that you need for this to be an issue that can be solved.
Absolutely not. Nobody likes to give up power. You know, and that St. Fortune's team that Maria Kinsella references gave emotional sacrifices. They gave up their crest, they gave up their jersey, but they gave it up for the future. And I'm, you know, looking at what the GPA and the women's GPA have agreed to do in the last number of weeks in order to amalgamate their 4,000 strong membership. The women's GPA have recognised that there's a 60-40 split in terms of the men's membership and the women's membership. So that is represented. There will be obviously more male representation on the executive committees because of the size of the membership. But 60-40 is better than 100-0, you know? So we have to respect that there will be things that will have to be given away in order to get the resources, in order to get equality.
Oh, and the Six Nations, we're going to touch upon Cheltenham and Rachel Blackmore in a little bit of a time on the show here on the Sunday Paper Review, but the Six Nations, 3 o'clock Ireland, Scotland, a range of writing from Neil Francis to Brendan Fanning to Hugh Farrelly. You've been picking out some of the best stories in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely, John. A range of headlines too, depending on, I suppose, depending on what perspective you're coming from. And there's a range of them in the papers today. And I think it's the Sunday Times that calls it win or bust. The Mail on Sunday with Hugh Farrelly, in fairness to Hugh, he calls it as he sees it and probably questions the selection policy ahead of today, feels it's very conservative, especially when you consider roads ahead in terms of developing talent. But the Six Nations, as we know, is a win business, and that's certainly what Brendan Fanning talks about today, the pressure that's on Ireland now, especially with the game between France and England, ending in a victory for England, who obviously are coming next weekend. And he does, I mean, to quote him here, he's fairly, I suppose, critical of Andy Farrell's first year and a half in charge, lack of preparation unfathomable, given the lead-in, lost valuable time in getting the right people around him and putting people into roles for which they didn't have the expertise. So fairly loading the pressure on the Irish team heading into this afternoon. Neil Francis is always probably sprinkled with a little bit of humour when he talks about Finn Russell. It's a very entertaining piece. It also talks about what's going on with CVC and the rugby rights. He says that with Russell on the pitch, Scotland always have a chance. And as long as Russell is on the pitch, Ireland also have a great chance. So, overall, some fairly strong pieces heaping the pressure that this is a must-win game for Ireland this afternoon.
Yeah, we live in a short-term world, and unfortunately, with Joe Schmidt, everything he did before the World Cup in Japan seemed to sometimes be forgotten. We're emerged from the Schmidt era, and We won, what, 3 championships in the Grand Slam under Schmidt. Mm-hmm. And he's defined Irish rugby. We won a handful of championships in the previous 50 years and only, what, 2 Grand Slams before he came into the gig. And I think that his departure has left a bit of a chasm. Addie Farrell worked with him. There's a continuity there. But there's an impatience there because of the success we had. We did everything we could in the world of rugby apart from performing at the World Cups. We did won 3 Six Nations. We beat New Zealand twice. We won down in Australia. We beat South Africa. And I think this is the time afterwards. And that's the challenge for Andy Farrell, and that's the challenge today. And it is a hard-hitting piece from Hugh Farrelly in the Mail that we see. The CVC issue, because you're involved in this game, involved in the sponsorship and sports agency business. What do you make of it?
I mean, in some respects, John, there's an inevitability to... CVC have been around global sport in the last 12, 18 months, acquiring various stakes in various sports properties, multi-million euro deals. And the piece actually, in fairness to Neil Francis today, talks about how CBC, now these deals, as we know, take months to be shaped, forged and agreed. But Neil Francis basically does say that you can't dismiss the fact that this is a particularly vulnerable time for the game of rugby, especially from the union's perspective, and you consider the revenue pressures they're under. I guess from a supporter's perspective, there's going to be an inevitable knock-on effect in terms of the TV rights, John. CVC at the end of the day, I think the stake is close to 14-15% that they've acquired in the Six Nations. And they will absolutely be looking to get a return on investment over the next 12, 24, 36 months. And that is going to inevitably, affect TV rights packages. It's been covered quite a lot during the week by yourselves as well, but it's hard to see a world where we don't have Six Nations games behind paywalls in the next 12 to 24 months. And, at the end of the day, we've seen that in other sports too, whether it's the GAA. I mean, whether we agree with these evolutions, revenue is needed to fund the games, and world sport has never been under more pressure, John. So, yeah, I do think we're going to see some seismic changes, especially from a TV, which then obviously has a knock-on effect in terms of the beauty about the Six Nations, of course, for so many years, it's been protected and it's beamed into millions of homes right across Ireland, right across the UK. But those days could be numbered.
I was reading that, Neil Francis. This whole deal, though, is a bit like borrowing the money lenders to pay for the kids' Christmas presents during tough times. CVC are 1/7 partner now and effectively control the competition. Once you sell the children, you won't get them back. Next weekend is the last time you'll watch international rugby on free-to-air TV. The rights are up, and that is when the Shylocks go to work. BBC and ITV had to look under the couch to find the dough, 90 million sterling, for the last batch of TV rights, but the word in the street is it'll be somewhere close to 4 times that figure when CBC go to work with a major player. Major implications for the fans, I think, Sarah, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Shane McGrath in the Irish Mail talks about it. He says the modern supporter is not wedded to the code like their parents were, which has helped rugby in particular to grow its sports base. But he said, were the most important test matches of the year to become the preserve of pay TV, then that base would be eroded. And that is not to mention the thousands of young supporters whose access to the game would be reduced to. That money matters, but tough decisions await the IRFU. And we're talking about exposure again. If you can't see it, you can't see it.
Yeah. So also that story in the front page of the Sunday Times about the fans being allowed in for the FA Cup final, you're involved in the events business, Owen. We're a long way off from that here. And this is all down to the vaccine, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you want to be as positive as possible too. We are at the beginning of the end in terms of some form of significant numbers being allowed to re-attend games at stadiums. I guess the challenge, I suppose, when you run into Christmas, John, there would have been a sense that at the tail end of the Six Nations, prior to what played out at Christmas, the hope might have been that Ireland-England, certainly next weekend, could have been one of the first games to tee up maybe 15-20% of supporters being allowed into the stadiums. We're obviously heavily involved in it ourselves with UEFA 2020, and there'll be decisions in the next number of weeks now as to what's going to play out for the 4 games that were due to take place here in Dublin. But certainly the prevailing mood music, there's no doubt about it, John, is that it's going to take probably the tail end of the vaccination program before government are potentially going to allow the kind of numbers that make sense for sports to get fans back into stadiums. So that could be too late in 2021 for Ireland. It may be that maybe the Autumn Nations has a chance, but you know, time will tell. But the rate of the vaccination program in the UK seems to be moving at a different pace. So hence the FA Cup final being slated there for fans to be attended. And they're going to use UEFA 2020-2021 in the UK to continue to test various scenarios. But very, very challenging for the business of sport and for fans. You know, we all absolutely love live experiences, and who doesn't want to get back into the Aviva or Croke Park sooner rather than later?
And also the impact on your business model and paying the bills and making ends meet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that goes right the way around, John. I mean, you know, we as a business of sports agency, we are inextricably linked to live sport. There's no getting away from it. I mean, in the last 12 months, to pivot, to use that term, I guess, you know, we developed a broadcasting and digital division. Leaders Lounge would probably be the most recognizable part of that, but it's been tremendously difficult for the wider sector, whose business models, to the exact point you made, John, are based on attendances. We've seen that right across the board, whether it's the IRFU, the GAA, the FAI, Athletics Ireland, Cycling Ireland, even at, you know, county board level. I know we're going to talk a little bit about Clare GAA a little bit later on, but you can see it even for county boards and sports at a local level, John, the gate receipts, and that's all oxygen to fuel the funding of the sport, the development of the sport. And in fairness to government, there have been funds made available that have allowed organisations to take over. But certainly sooner rather than later, we're getting back out onto the pitches. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, we were speaking on OTB Football Saturday about the amateur clubs in soccer in Ireland and the struggles they're going through. And maybe they're a little bit forgotten. To be realistic, can you see a European Championship schedule in Dublin this summer?
It's a difficult one, John. I mean, the mood music and the prevailing winds are challenging. We could have done with potentially, you know, some games in Croke Park. If you can recall, I think, you know, we were going to go with an intra-county season potentially starting February and March. The same with the Six Nations. It would have been good to see some case studies there for us to work off. It's going to be challenging. It's hard to call. There's individuals at higher levels making those decisions than I, but we remain hopeful, but it's difficult.
On Tuesday, Rachel Blackmore from Tipperary bids to win the champion hurdle. No woman jockey's ever done that in the history of Cheltenham. And Eamon Sweeney's written a piece at the back of the Sunday Independent about it, Sarah.
Yes, and I'm such a fan of Eamon Sweeney normally, but the tone of this piece appears kind of jaded. And in making the point about Blackmore on the brink of writing a new history, he slated other sports that didn't need, the optics. And, you know, he speaks about sportswomen are seeking greater respect and recognition. The public has greater interest in hearing about them, and the media is making a long overdue attempt at giving them greater exposure. I don't think it's an attempt, you know. I think that was probably a word that would have been better suited there. It's certainly not attempt. And he talks about the World Cup in USA football team. And he's talking, obviously, comparing men's sport to women's sport. Again, something we don't need to do. And he says they would struggle against the schoolboy side. I don't think that's a comparison that we need to make. And it's certainly a comparison that hasn't been tested. So we don't need to see that in the papers. And he says afterwards, it hardly matters whether that's the case or not. But again, something that he shouldn't have said. And then he comes around with a sweeping piece about Rachel Blackmore and, you know, I suppose the narrative that in Ireland, we don't hold her up to the same standard as they have in the UK in terms of Briony Frost, because we recognise that Rachel Blackmore is a jockey, first and foremost, and we don't see her exploits as particularly grandiose in her sport because she's just doing her job. We recognise that she's a brilliant sports person, but in the UK, they tend to, overinflate the personalities that do well in women's sports in order to give them that exposure. And Eamon makes the point that we're not paying Rachel lip service. We're saying that she's a great jockey. So I would have loved if the whole tone of the piece had been positive, but he's made some comments at the beginning of the piece that I just feel didn't need to be said.
Okay. It's not the only piece around Cheltenham, which starts on Tuesday. Mick Winters is a colourful Cork trainer, and Dara Crohor has done a piece as well in the Sunday Independent. Owen, about him.
Yeah, it certainly caught my eye, John. I guess Cheltenham is probably one of those times of years, a bit like myself, that non-racing aficionados or fans would be drawn towards, given the spectacle that it is. And you are inevitably drawn towards pieces that, like Dara has done here with Mick, which are a real, real colourful character. He talks at length about Mick's history in the sport, a very coloured character at the best of times. He talks and he delivers some beautiful vignettes as well in relation to Mick about how for Bill, a horse that Mick's own, Mick was owned by Dan Sheehan, a friend of Mick's, and for a long time now, Donny Sheehan was his name. And Mick continues to bring a photo of Donny with him when he goes across, specifically racing in the UK with the chance of meeting the Queen, because apparently Donny and the Queen share the same birthday. So the plan is at some stage that Mick is going to be able to present that photograph to the Queen, and probably with the week that was in it, the Queen could do with a little bit of levity like that. But yeah, there's some excellent pieces. And to Sarah's point as well, I was taken in by, I thought Eamon's piece as well was going to be a little bit different to what it played out in terms of talking up what Rachel Blackmore has history on the horizon this week. So it's going to be a great week of racing at Cheltenham. And obviously it's been a tough couple of weeks for the sport, to put it mildly. But the piece on Mick by Dara is certainly worth the read this morning.
Yeah, some of the quotes. For a long time, Winters worked in the old Roundtree's chocolate factory in Cork before it closed down. His wife, Patricia, joined the local fire brigade to help keep the ship afloat. And talk about Tom Foley, who trained Denoli, who recently passed away in 1994. Denoli went and won at Cheltenham. Tom Foley, the poor old divil, was awesome what he did when he got the good horse, what he did for the people. It goes back to the love of the horse. Tom is grand and humble, and there are plenty of days when things weren't going well. So you have to measure it, don't you? Enjoy it, but don't get carried away.
One other point I was going to make on that piece as well, which I thought is absolutely fascinating. And sometimes as well, as I said, I wouldn't be a huge racing man, but when you listen to pundits, whether it's Patrick Mullins or Jay Mangan, talk about the horses and the preparation that goes into them. There's just an interesting, just at the tail end of the piece, it talks about, I think, that Mick and the team are going to head over in the ferry tomorrow, because last year, Chatham Street Lord, which is the horse that he's going over with, for whatever reason, wouldn't drink water for 24 hours after arriving in the UK. So at times it just shines a light on, you know, the high performance animals, that the nuances that are there that trainers etc. have to prepare for.
And also we're going to see Denise Foster isn't going to Cheltenham. Sarah, I read that in the Sunday Times. It's an interesting piece.
She's missed a couple of weeks this week, and perhaps is, you know, looking to stay out of the limelight and concentrate on the horses. I read that she has 200 horses under her care now that she needs to know intimately as quickly as she can. But I think the piece spoke as well about, while Gordon Elliott was obviously at the top, the structure that's around him would allow her to be able to use all of the people in that structure to gain the knowledge that she needs to manage the Calentra until he's back, you know. And I think it's probably a wise move for her to stay out of the limelight over the next couple of weeks. I know Megan and Harry, Megan spoke about staying out of the limelight because she was told to, and perhaps there's just less of an exposure element if you're not at Cheltenham, you know, and she'll be able to do her work in a more peaceful manner.
It took 29 minutes, Sarah, for you to get a Megan and Harry reference in. Oh, and I'm disappointed you didn't get it in first.
I thought it was the Queen that needed the lift given the week that was in it. Yeah, I was close to Megan and Harry, but I leave that one to Sarah.
Well, I think Denise should take Megan's advice and try and stay out of the limelight this week. Stay in the background. there's just too many questions that she'll have to answer that won't be about the horses, is my feeling.
Yeah, some of the quotes in the Sunday Times piece. Elliot suffered it for a couple of years until he built a bespoke apartment next to the tack room in the middle of the yard. This is in Coventry Stables in Meath. A two-story affair, three upstairs bedrooms and no commute. If the IHRB had decided to make him a disqualified person, Elliot would not have been allowed to set foot in any training yard and he would have been forced to leave his home. But suspending his licence, none of that was necessary. Denise Foster will not be in Cheltenham this week. It was too late for the realms of COVID-19 paperwork anyway. At about a third of Irish trainers and runners at the meeting are staying at home. The horses will run in her name this week, each one inseparable from Elias. Cheltenham, though, will be better for the horses. I don't even really know what that last line meant about Cheltenham. And lots of stuff about William Mullins. How does he do as David Walsh in the Sunday Times writing about William Mullins. 1995 to 2009, 17 festival winners. 2010 to 2020, 57 festival winners. Also criticism of Cheltenham. Philip Quinn recounting what the experience was like last year. Shane McGrath being quite critical of it in the Daily Mail. Did you touch upon that one, Sarah, Shane McGrath?
I actually only looked at CVC with Shane McGrath.
So what did he say about CVC?
His basic point was about exposure, you know, and talking about sponsors and the ever-increasing demands that they're placing on the sports that they look to engage with. And I suppose this was a conversation that I was hoping to pick up with Owen. How close do sponsors want to get to the pitch? You know, we've had a situation in Camogie previously where Ashley Thompson, who's obviously a very famous Camogie player, was wearing branded headbands. Her Hurley was branded. She was wearing armbands. Because obviously it was identified that she was going to be followed by the camera quite prolifically and this was an opportunity. So where do sponsors sit in terms of getting to the pitch, literally, with sponsorship on?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Some of my audio use there is coming in now, but I think the question is about the proximity of sponsors and maybe... in-game, whether it's in-game technology or branding on players. I think that, look, we've seen some very ham-fisted approaches over the years. I mean, there was the famous, trying to recall now, I mean, be careful now, John, I'm trying to think which players it was. It might have been Cork players, and there was Corona Extra, and there was Paddy Power involved in branding on, or guerrilla marketing, really. But the digital evolution of sponsorship engagement now is probably going to see, Sarah, a move away from the more on-pitch related guerrilla style or over-the-top branding and sponsoring of athletes that traditionally was where maybe the boundaries were pushed. We're certainly seeing that. I mean, there's one way of looking at everything that's happened in COVID over the last 12 to 18 months is that it's forcing sponsors to look at how it engages consumers much more comprehensively than maybe in the past. So digital and getting closer to I suppose your heroes is something that's, you know, sponsors are always trying to be that bridge for those moments. I mean, you look at some of the access as well. Now this is some of the challenge you see for sponsors. I mean, when you look at platforms now like Drive to Survive or Tom versus Time, which is an NFL documentary, so Drive to Survive is with Formula One, the access that you know, both the sponsors and the motor companies are allowing is unprecedented, and that's just raising the bar all the time. And sometimes those lines get blurred and you get unfortunate incidents where something is done just in poor taste and doesn't reflect very well on the brand, the sponsor or the sport, to be honest.
We're obviously talking about CBC and we're talking about them wanting to get back, you know, 426 million pretty quickly. So TV rights deals is one way of doing that. And I suppose my concern will be in other areas when you're looking at the GA stadiums and naming rights. You know, we're talking about growing the sport and sustaining the sport and ever-increasing GA bills. I know Pat Spillane's talking in the Sunday World about the out of control spending of county boards, and perhaps because the government identified level 5 restrictions of not allowing the GA back into play, that county boards, because of, you know, the money that they don't have, they were quite happy to sit quietly for another month or two. I would be uncomfortable about renaming Sebel Stadium or renaming Parky Kyiv in an effort to grow the sport. I think we have to at some point call a halt to where money and tradition come together. Is there a pushback, Owen, in terms of that?
Would there be a pushback from fans? Is it, Sarah? Sorry, I'm just...
Yeah, would there be a pushback in terms of the sponsors if they said, look, we can't get you the naming rights?
No, not necessarily, Sarah, because there's so many precedents there at the moment now in terms of stadium naming rights, I think is one you've touched on there. You know, probably the Aviva was the marquee deal here a number of years ago. I think what you're talking about, though, is quite correct, is that with the pressure that, whether it's the pressure coming from the likes of a CVC as a private equity player to get return out of a platform like the Six Nations, for sure, we touched on the TV rights already, but you're absolutely right. There's huge pressure on governing bodies at sports at all levels to continue to deliver their revenues and funding when so many platforms have been lost to them. So that's where government and the departments of sport, probably from an Irish perspective, need to step in to keep sport from maybe selling its soul in the short term to stave off some of the financial challenges that COVID has brought.
This is the Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball with Sarah O'Donovan, the former All-Ireland winning camogie player with Cork and also Dublin player. She moved to Dublin. And a Clare man, Owen Conroy, CEO of Titan Experience, a sports events and experiential company dealing with brands and sporting bodies. Interesting on that. I think it hasn't really penetrated the consciousness of the public because a really big stadium hasn't been sponsored in GA. So Porky Cueve, Semple Stadium, Croke Park. Like we've got Wexford Park is sponsored. You had Netwatch Cullen Park, you had LIT get a grounds. A really big one is when I think you'll have a tipping point. At the moment, it's a little bit under the radar for me.
It'll break my heart if it happens. I just think there's things, and as Owen said, the government will need to step in. We need to keep hold of some of the things that we've built so well.
We got a really positive story in Gaelic Games, just in Graeme Geraghty in The Sun, we'll get to in a moment. But this, and this is irrelevant to you, Owen, because you're from Clare, and you're going to be on this independent committee to review matters in Clare Gaelic Games. When you pick up the Sunday Times today and you open up the Michael Foley and Dennis Walsh article and it says, call this a centre of excellence about Cathair Lowen, what's your immediate feeling?
Actually, my wife warned me about not getting too worked up. I mean, you know, they often say, John, a week is a long time in politics, and this must be the, I'd say, fourth or fifth week out of six that Clare GAA has been, you know, for all the wrong reasons, you know, centre page news in the sports supplements, and this morning is no different. I mean, look, you deal in the facts. I mean, Mick and Dennis have gone to great lengths, obviously, to research the piece. And I'm sure when people get an opportunity later today, whether it's you're a Clare GAA fan or you're involved in GAA in general, I mean, it's appalling. I mean, you know, you're embarrassed, I'll be honest with you. John, I know you have Clare DNA as well. And in a way, maybe it does bring to the fore the issues that are really at play, because sometimes a lot of what's said around Clare GAA is getting lost in the personalities, when at the heart of it, these are some of the things that are really affecting the great GAA people that we have in Clare. You know, three All-Irelands in the last 25 years, we should be building for progress. And this was to be, you know, Cathair Lowen was to be that platform, John. And one of the things that certainly jumped out to me was the fact that Croke Park at 1.8 million and the Munster Council at over €500,000. You did mention, I'm on a committee that's going to work very, very hard with the county board on a range of strategic areas we're going to look at. But I'd be very surprised not to see Croke Park or the Munster Council sooner rather than later intervene here and start asking the questions and talk to those who are accountable to get the answers. Because the pictures, if they say a picture paints a thousand words, John, you don't even need to read the article. you know. So yeah, it's pretty damning for all involved. And as I said, it at some stage, definitely, maybe it's a Croke Park intervention that's needed here to address what's going on, because it does look, and I think Mick touched on it, that it could be anywhere where another $500,000 in funding is needed. But where are you going to get that, John, at the moment? You know, who's going to sponsor Clare GAA when you're looking at what's going on? And I take no pride in saying that, to be quite honest. But you can't get away from the facts, and accountability is needed. A line needs to be drawn sooner rather than later, and we try to move on. So, yeah, it's hard to read, I won't lie.
I'm going to read out some of it. In 2005, $2.3 million was spent on the purchase of Carhartt, the centre of excellence for Clare GAA. There's no medical room, no defibrillator has been installed by the end of last year. There are no public toilets. The car park remains unfinished. The pungent smell from the water was so strong, some players over the years have preferred to shower at home. In 2019, County Treasurer Michael Gallagher put the cost of Carhartt at $4.8 million. And instead of offering a foundation for Clare's biggest ambitions, Carhartt has become a source of extreme antagonism, from the county hurlers exiled to the road by the poor facilities, to ongoing questions over the return on the money invested in developing the site, to scepticism over the committee formed this year to examine the problems. Doesn't make for a nice reading, as you said, Owen. What are you hoping then, as an independent committee, to achieve in Clare? What is your ultimate goal here? Is it to really hold the county board to account, because it seems pretty clearly that there's a management issue here?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult for an independent committee to hold, I suppose, any county board to account, John. I mean, I think that's where Croke Park needs to support some of the changes that are required. There's no doubt about that. But as an independent committee, and in fairness, the county board have looked to ratify the Aerobe motion, which has put this committee in play. I mean, our job is to bring as much expertise and professionalism as possible, and what's required, certainly over the next 3 to 6 months, to look at the governance structures, to look at the processes and procedures. And, you know, you can talk about those things and they sound like words, and you can talk about it all day long, John. But when you look at the facts in the Sunday Times today in that piece, it is broken. So that's what our committee is set up to do, to work with the county board. But we are going to need additional help as well. And we need Carhartt for young players. I mean, you could talk to Brian Lohan in the morning with Tony Kelly, Johnny Conlon, these guys. They would love to have Carhartt where it needs to be, but it's more about for the younger players, the development squad players, for football and hurling coming in. So that's what we're, it's about protecting the future of Clare GAA, but Carhartt needs to be addressed now.
And if you look at Limerick across the Shannon...
Oh, stop. I know, I was waiting for you to... Yeah, go on.
I just said it. Sarah, do you have a... You must be reading this and going, as a former player, what is going on here?
From a player's perspective, if you can see that they're talking about the pitches have been deemed unsuitable for hurling. Is that not a scary stat? You know, another stat is that it'll cost between $150,000 and $500,000 a year to maintain and have the facility opened all year round. Owen, have you considered where that money would come from if you were, you know, responsible? How can you generate $150,000 to $500,000 just to sustain a property, keep it open?
Yeah, I agree with you, Sarah. And that's why, I mean, the project very clearly, I guess, from the facts as they're laid out in the piece, is at a massive crossroads. I'm not even sure if those figures add up, to be quite honest. I don't think there's any real clarity as to exactly where we're at and where we need to go with Carhartt. I think that's probably the most worrying and urgent part of where we're at. So, you know, those kind of numbers, as you said, you know, do they stand up to scrutiny? I don't know. And that's obviously a couple of the areas that we'll be focusing on over the next number of weeks, for sure.
Can you, though, easily solve what obviously seems to me to be a lot of personality issues in the county of Clare, and it seems to be difference of opinion on certain sides and certain parts of the county board and people outside of that, and the way Clare GAA should be run? When you're looking at the hurlers, no Munster under 21s in 5 years, no minor championships since 2011, no Munster senior hurling championships in 1998. Limerick have won the last two minors. They're going for a third All Ireland in 4 years. Their academy's been brilliant over the last 10 years. What's it going to take to sort Clare hurling out? Primarily because obviously it's a bigger sport than football in the county, so that you'd be competitive again.
Well, change is needed, John, from the top down. There's no doubt about it. I mean, and accountability is needed to look at those in situ at the moment and open those conversations. It's not about saying that we want or anybody wants people to lose jobs. I mean, the GAA is a volunteer organisation. There's great volunteers in Clare like there is every place else. But there is a massive crossroads we've reached at. And it starts with the county board and it starts with those accountable. And if it starts with Cathalone and looking to address that and address it now, not in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, meetings, committees. Committees will take care of that, working with the county board in time. But I think Cathalone is for Clare GAA now, is a point of no return. And we either address it, hit it head on, and look to put a proper facility, and a plan is needed to take it up to where it needs to be. So there are some of the challenges. And we've won three All-Irelands too, John, in the last 25 years. So we can't shy away from some of these challenges.
Absolutely. Just also reference a story in the Sun Independent from Dermot Crowe. Supporters Club is run separately to the County Board. Clare County Board has stated there's no knowledge or responsibility for accounts held by the Supporters Club during the time Davy Fitzgerald was manager of the County Senior Hurlers. A spokesman said the club had been totally independent of the board but provided invaluable support in meeting county team preparation costs. In his book All Costs, published in 2018, Fitzgerald praised the activity of the Supporters Club. He was instrumental in setting up and helping to run while in charge of the county team from 2012 to 2016. He vouched for its transparency. Every single cent raised in quotes was accounted for, every detail presented to the audit committee. And that's what makes my blood boil when even to this day some smart asses toss out that lazy question, where did the money go? Open your eyes, ask the audit committee, ask the county board. These are the quotes from Davy Fitzgerald. But the board says it's unable to provide that information as to how the money's raised or who they get it from or anything else. That's nothing to do with the county board. County PRO Michael O'Connor explained to the Sunday Independent. So that is an interesting story. Do you want to comment on that, Owen?
I mean, look, again, John, is it, when you look at, you know, it's been the Sunday Times and Sunday Independent, you know, from a paper perspective, and quality journalists have been following these stories. So clearly they believe something is there, that they're asking questions in relation to. And when you see other areas like the one that's reflected in that piece in the Sunday Independent today, you're not surprised, because when you look at what's happening with Cathalone, it's just another example of those structures, governance being broken. It's not that they're fractured, they're broken. And yeah, it just doesn't make easy reading, John. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, I'd expect Clare is not the only county as well where the tight governance that you need from Croke Park on that professional level is not fully in place. It doesn't mean that anything untoward has happened, but it just means that just the tightening the bolts of governance and getting everything right and everything transparent, just in terms of value for money. And that's what we're asking for. Your experience as a player in various counties, Sarah, what would you have seen when it came to having that really tight governance around how money is spent and spent well?
Obviously, from Clark's point of view, that would have been 2005, 2006, 2007, when I was playing senior with Cork. And that was during the Celtic Tiger era. In terms of sponsors, I suppose the things that were provided to us as players at that point were well set out by the county board. In terms of the extras, you know, fundraising for team holidays after winning All-Ireland, there was audit committees put in place. We held fundraising dinners. Big businesses in Cork supported us. It was always very visible in terms of what was raised, where the money went, who supported us. There was all trails in terms of who we thanked, who was identified. There was a relationship with the county board in terms of what we were doing. Moving to Dublin, AIG is obviously a big sponsor of ladies football, Mogi, men's side of things. It's across the four clubs. A designated budget has been given to Mogi Associates, Mogi in Dublin, to satisfy demands of I suppose, two senior teams, minor teams, 16 teams. I don't necessarily understand how the money is split out across the different age groups, but we don't have our own pitches, so we're renting pitches on an annual basis. I know Maria Kinsella is talking about a new report, which is going to identify how much money is being spent by Camogie and ladies football on rent every year. And I think that's really going to shine a light on how much money is being wasted by us sitting outside of the GAA, and where the money could be invested in ladies football and Camogie by having us under the umbrella, not having to pay for renting of pitches, as an example.
That makes complete sense. And, like, you know, it's time the common sense prevailed, and there is some kind of merger in the future. Graham Garrity, and this is in the Sun, this is just a good story. I'm taking every day as it comes, trying not to worry about trivial things. If I can bring it up here. I'm just glad to be alive. Graham Garrity, absolutely legendary football, our All-Ireland winning captain in 1999 with Meath. This is Gordon Manning writing this in the Sun. It is not yet 5 months since Meath's 1999 All-Ireland winning captain suffered a brain aneurysm that almost cost him his life. On the night of Tuesday, October 27th, he was coming to the end of his day working as a social care team leader with Three Steps in Trim. Shortly after 10 o'clock, Garrity was chatting with his colleague Ian Daly when a sudden shooting pain in his forehead caused him to jolt. Within seconds, it had surged down the back of his head and down his neck. Garrity recalled, "Ian thought I was having a stroke. He put me lying on the couch, rang an ambulance, kept me talking to me to keep me conscious. The pain was so severe the two-time All-Ireland winner couldn't keep his eyes open. He'd suffered from migraine in the past, but did not need a doctor to tell him this was something altogether different. The pain he endured was like nothing he'd ever experienced. He was exhausted but unable to sleep, hungry but unable to eat. He had a very successful operation, which is in Beaumont Hospital. An aneurysm and stage 4 bleed were confirmed. 24 hours later, he underwent life-saving surgery. No visitors permitted because of COVID-19 restrictions. All he could do was wait and worry. He was informed of their risks. The two-time All-Star recalled, "It was hard because you had nobody around, so you were left in there in the bed on your own waiting for an operation you might not come back from." And he recalled, "The pain was just so horrific, it wasn't getting any better. I wouldn't be religious, but at one stage I just remember saying, 'God, just let me go, just let me die.'" So he has made a recovery, and Graham Garrity. And just at the end here of the piece, I can't thank the doctors and nurses enough. They're incredible. I realise that if I didn't have the operation I did then, I might not be here now. Or if I was here, I might not be in the capacity that I am. So I'm thankful to them. I'm just taking every day as it comes, hoping to continue getting better. I'm trying not to worry about trivial things. Mostly, I'm just glad to be alive. The most touching piece I've definitely read today.
Yeah, John, it's certainly touched a chord with myself. My own dad suffered a brain injury, a little bit more, unfortunately, devastating than Graham's, about 14 years ago, but made a brilliant recovery. And geez, my heart goes out to, and I'm delighted to hear the progress he's making, especially for the Garrity family and his wider family, because certainly we've been on a journey for the last 14, 15 years with dad that, it does get better every day, but it's very, very tough. It's great to hear Graham write about it as well so openly, because brain injuries, sometimes they can be quite silent and quite personal, you know. I mean, Sir Alex Ferguson as well, obviously, in the last couple of years has written about his own recovery. So absolutely delighted for the Garrity family, and I wish Graham well.
You never know, do you, Sarah?
No, and I remember 99, obviously, when Meath beat Cork. And Graham Garrity was such a stalwart that day. And it's people like that who have taken all of the right decisions along the way and been so fit and so healthy. And for that to happen, it's incredible to think that he can be struck down so easily.
Yeah, a really nice interview with Gordon Manning and this on the Independent with Graham Garrity. The link with Alex Ferguson, Graham Garrity was Alex Ferguson went to see the Leinster final in 1994, Meath and the Dubs, and he commented on Graham Garrity after the game, and then Graham Garrity got a try with Arsenal, and Paul Merson said he's the fittest player he'd ever seen. Yeah. He's a professional, and Graham Garrity was an amateur. There's a good story that you both like on Daniel McDonald's done a piece with the Drogheda United manager in the Sunday Independent.
Really interesting piece, actually. I suppose my take on it was a great quote about you can't have an ego when you need to feed the children. It's Tim Cahill. Now I'll just open it up. He talks about, first and foremost, his experience of being in Scotland and making very wise decision with his money to buy a BMW. It was a BMW, I think, when he couldn't afford it. And coming back to Ireland, weighing £15,000 and having to give up the car. And I think his first message to footballers is, you really have to cut your cloth to suit your measure in that money as a footballer beyond those who are making absolute millions is the same as everyone else. You know, it runs out. And that was the first message that I took from it.
I know, and you liked the piece as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's fairness to Daniel. He gets some great stuff out of him. And it's funny, John. It's often like Sarah touched on there. Some of the players, I think Fergal Harkin was in a very interesting piece last week as well, the exposed player, I think, in terms of his work with Man City. And it's just great to follow the and get an insight and a window into what maybe might be described. Eamon Dunphy was on Tommy Tiernan last night, described himself as a journeyman footballer. But sometimes some of those stories like Tim's, talk about a life less ordinary in football and forging a career in football.
We got Padraig Harrington in the Irish Daily Mail on Sunday talking about his wins in Florida. He was speaking to Philip Quinn. Just interesting on playoffs. He was saying that golfers going to playoffs. You could see it tonight with Bryson DeChambeau and Lee Westwood. I've seen guys that get into playoffs. They're all excited. Constantino Rocca, Jean Van de Velde, for example, at the Open. I don't see it that way. It's the next hole of a tournament. You've got a chance to win. You shake hands firmly. You look at the guy in the eye and then you try and win. You can't show any weakness. So Padraig Harrington at nearly the right ball age of 50, talking about his career with Philip Quinn. Also, I suppose it's worth mentioning that there's articles as well in the not only the Sunday Times, but the Irish Daily Mail on Sunday about this British cycling issue with Richard Freeman. Did an interview with Nick Harris. There was only one question anybody wanted to ask Dr. Richard Freeman on Friday after he was found guilty of ordering banned testosterone in 2011 while knowing or believing it was to improve an unnamed rider's performance. Who was the rider? And he's done an interview. It's so disappointing. He says, it's unbelievable. I've never doped a rider in my life. Still, to see any evidence of who this rider supposedly was, I accept there are people who don't believe me. They will say I've lied and changed my story and can't trust anything I say. I've admitted to those lies. And the problem with Richard Freeman is it is hard for people to believe in him. This is what he says later in the interview. I believe in due process. He says, I believe in evidence. I'm not a doper. David Walsh writing at the back of the Sunday Times about it, and taking David Brailsford, who was the boss of Team Sky, to account. Came as no surprise the medical tribunal did not accept Dr. Freeman's story, ruling instead that he had ordered the testosterone knowing or believing it was for an athlete. They'll soon reconvene. There'll be a judgment on whether Freeman is fit to continue practicing medicine. Remember, this was the chief doctor for British cycling for nearly a decade, for Team Sky as well, and there's no end in sight for, this is the quote, for what's been a grim episode. UK anti-doping's charged Dr. Freeman with anti-doping violations, and the judgment from the medical tribunal will be used in the case against the doctor. I can't help feeling some sympathy for Freeman. And David Walsh writes, he is in part a fall guy in a story far greater than him. And he concludes, in the early years when David Brailsford was selling us the vision of the Team Sky he wanted to create, he was an interview waiting to happen, a master of the clever slogan. He introduced the British public to the concept of marginal games and had a talent for seeming the cleverest man in the room. Nobody used the power of communication more effectively than he did, and now he is silent. Sometimes you don't need evidence, folks. Sometimes you don't need evidence to know that a reputation can be tarnished without it, is what I'd say.
I read the piece with Nick Harris, and obviously Nick Harris appears very sympathetic to Freeman's position and inferred at the end that Freeman has found God essentially by going back in to help with the vaccines. But ultimately, if he was protecting Shane Sutton, as he says he was, in terms of Shane Sutton's requirement to use testajol for erectile dysfunction, as he claims, it seems a heavy price to protect somebody in order to lose your license or to be banned from working with the doctor. It's a difficult story to swallow, yeah. as a spectator.
Absolutely. We're nearly out of time on the Sunday Paper Review. Sarah Donovan and Owen Conroy. Just give us one maybe people should be looking at later in the day. Any stories otherwise that we should be looking at from the Sunday Papers today?
Very quickly, there's a lovely piece in the Business Post with Natalia Coyle and her partner, Arthur Lanigan O'Keefe, and both heading to the Olympics or hoping to, and worth a look, just in terms of commitment and also the way they have married their relationship and their Olympic ambition.
And Owen, anything else you like that we should be looking at?
Just well worth a read, because he's a character and he knows what he's talking about. Mick Galway has a great little piece on the game this afternoon in the Sunday World. It's well worth a little look.
Okay. Well, Owen Conroy and Sarah Donovan, thanks so much for giving us your insight on the Sunday Paper Review. Look forward to speaking to you soon. Stay safe and enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
You, John.
Okay, Sarah Donovan and Owen Conroy there. Thanks for giving our insight in our paper review today. And also, Off the Ball, just to let you know, is on your radio from 1 to 7 today on News Talk and on the OTB Sports app. You've got two live and exclusive Premier League commentary games to give you. Stephen Doyle and Kenny Cunningham calling the shots for the North London Derby, Arsenal taking on Tottenham at the Emirates Stadium. Also showcasing the game involving Leicester City and Sheffield United. Nathan Murphy and Brian Kerr in the commentary box for that one. Mike McCarthy will also keep us up to date on Ireland and Scotland in the Six Nations. If you missed any of the Sunday paper review, you can check out the podcast on the OTB Sports app or wherever you get your pods. You can also watch it back on YouTube on the Off the Ball channel. We're back on your radio from 1 o'clock.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.